captures the music, the crowd, and the essence of such jazz greats as Louis Armstrong, Thelonious Monk, Jerry Mulligan, and Anita O'Day. Jazz on a Summer's Day, Thursday, August 14, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street, Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Rockin' chair's got me.
Old rocking chair got your father.
KBOO Community Radio proudly co-sponsors the Surf Rider Summer Soiree on Thursday, July 17th from 6 p.m. until 1 a.m. at Holocene, located at 1001 Southeast Morrison. This fundraiser opens with an ocean art show and silent auction, followed by a screening of the surf film Seven Signs. Then the reggaetronic five-piece band Everyday Prophets takes center stage at 10 p.m. Again, that's the Surf Rider Summer Soiree on July 17th. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a local houseless rights activist is convicted for the crime of helping houseless people under the Burnside Bridge. And a local immigrant rights group takes a stand for marriage equality.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 16, 2014. I'm Yana.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Houseless rights activist Ibrahim Mubarak has been found guilty of trespassing and interfering with a police officer. A jury returned the verdict after a two-day trial. Mubarak had elected to go to trial after being arrested under the Burnside Bridge on February 27th, where he and others had been checking on houseless people sleeping there near the White Stag building owned by the University of Oregon and the offices of Mercy Corps. Police called to the scene said Mubarak refused to leave the property when asked, and he was arrested. Mubarak is the co-founder of the Right to Dream 2 Houseless Rest Area and Dignity Village. KBOO's Mike Klepfer spoke with him after his sentencing.
Can you tell us what happened today?
What happened today was that I got convicted of interfering with a police officer and criminal trespass, too.
That's after your trial?
Yes, after the trial. I took it to a jury trial. And again, what that shows that different social status that enter into the fact of what's happening in the houseless community have no reality of what's happening in the streets. And if they have any inkling on how the houseless people are treated and how they live, I believe the decision would have been different. And that just tells me and proves we got to do more outreach, not just to the houseless community, but to the house community, to inform them and make them aware of what's happening to people with no income or low income, with nowhere to go or nowhere to live or sleep.
So you were arrested in February for...
February 27th
for checking on some people that were...
We were doing outreach under the Burnside Bridge to the, where a congregation of houseless people found safety to sleep together and get out the elements as they used the bridge, the canopy, so the rain wouldn't fall on them in that, you know, in the cold months of winter here in Portland. And in doing that, they were told that they had to stay strict on the sidewalk, and if they step off the curb, they would get arrested or give a trespassing and exclusion citation, where when we went down there, it was nowhere for us to walk to do outreach to this houseless community. So we was walking in the parking lot, which was stated as public, as private property. So the security guard, in their infinite wisdom, called the police because they seen more people than they seen before and said it was like an irate situation. And it wasn't. And even if you watch the video, you can see how they was laughing and joking and answering our questions, and there was no irateness about it. However, the police decided to target me and bypass the rest of the activists that was with me and come to me and question me and tell me that I had to leave. And thinking and believing and knowing I was doing what was right and trying to comfort people was having no comfort, I rejected their request, and that's where the war started, where who was going to be strong and move first and who was going to impose their authority over one another. So by them being the police and having the right to arrest you anytime they want to, whether they right or wrong, they arrested me. And so we decided to bring it to a court and to a jury.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you were in police custody, they made discriminatory remarks toward you. Is that right?
Yeah, and that can be another case, but this case was about me disobeying a police order and criminal trespass. While I was in custody, they ran my name and my birth name. My parents came up, and I told them that wasn't my name. I legally changed my name 25 years ago, and every time I go into this judicial system here in Portland, Oregon, that they give me a problem about my spirituality. And so one of the guys said, we're not going to call you what your mammy, no, we're not going to call you what Alibaba called you. We're going to call you what your mommy called me. Mm-hmm. And they wanted me to sign the name she named me. And when I didn't sign those paper with that oppressive name that they give African Americans, I was thrown in a hole with no clothes on in a cold room for 2 hours.
Mm. So what's up next for you?
What's up next for me? They put me on bench probation for a year, and I can't get into a verbal confrontation with the police. And that's going to be real, 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 real hard. So I'm going to have to sew my lips together like the injured Columbia GM workers, you know.
Yeah.
And I had to do 80 hours of community service, and they didn't want none of the community service that I'm used to doing. So I'll probably be going around with Greg Margolis and the food wheel, giving elder people food and stuff.
All right.
Yeah, I can't do anything with the homeless, which that is the real community service.
All right. Thank you for your time.
No problem.
This is Mike Klepfer, KBOO News.
The Oregon Zoo Foundation is hosting their annual fundraiser, Zoolala, this coming Saturday, July 19th. But the fundraising gala event will face silent protesters as they enter the event. A silent protest of what protesters say is the Oregon Zoo Foundation's funding of elephant abuse, also known as Bulala, is being organized by the group Free the Oregon Zoo Elephants. Last year's event raised more than $260,000 to, quote, create a better future for wildlife. Critics say a large portion of money raised funds that ended up creating abusive conditions for the 8 zoo elephants. They say that the elephants suffer from a variety of life-threatening illnesses and conditions related to their captivity, including tuberculosis, which now affected Paki, Rama, and Tusco. Both events will take place this Saturday, July 19th, from 4:30 to 7 p.m. at the Oregon Zoo. For more information on the protest, you can visit freeoregonzooelephants.org.
The local nonprofit Vaz Workers' Rights Education Project has decided to stand up for marriage equality and give up a grant that would provide one quarter of the organization's annual budget. Vaz provides training and support for workers and runs a day laborer hire site on Northeast Martin Luther King Boulevard in Portland. The group had not taken a stand on marriage equality in the past, but a Catholic organization that was offering the group funding had demanded that Vaz renounce ties with a national Latino rights organization that has taken a stand in favor of marriage equality. Vaz refused and has decided to stand on the side of equality for all rather than accept funding from a group that does not share those values. For more, KBU spoke with Ronfis Vietoro from Vaz.
I wonder if you can tell us about the decision to refuse a grant from a Roman Catholic organization because of the demands that were made by that granting organization.
It was our board who ultimately made a decision, and the decision technically wasn't to refuse a grant, but our decision was technically to not to disaffiliate from NCLR. Back in last fall, we applied for the national grant from CCHD, Catholic Campaign for Human Development. So we applied for a grant back in fall, and by mid-May, we were told that there was an issue with our affiliation with NCLR. And by June 1st, we were asked that in order to receive the grant that we had submitted, we would have to disaffiliate from NCLR due to their advocacy on marriage equality. So our board decided that we could not consciously disaffiliate from NCLR, especially knowing that it was over marriage equality.
What is NCLR and what is their stance on the issue of marriage equality?
That's a good question. NCLR is National Council of La Raza. A way I could describe them is they're sort of similar to in national scope as the NAACP, but NCLR focuses on the Latino community. Instead of operating with chapters, they operate by having affiliates that pay dues. NCLR is basically the largest Latino civil rights organization in the United States. They do advocacy on a wide range of issues, such as immigration. But for our purposes, for the purposes of the organization, we've been a part affiliate of NCLR as a funder to be able to operate our worker center. NCLR, National Council of RASA, has done advocacy on marriage equality in the federal level, and that played a role in the grant-making process.
What was the reason that the board then decided to remain affiliated with NCLR, the National Council of La Raza?
I think the biggest reason really was about our values. Our values as an organization, about being for equal rights for everyone. I think from the day laborers, which are our constituents and also represent the board, We've always strived to be an opening and affirming community for everyone at our worker center and not discriminate based off race, sex, gender, or sexual orientation. And we felt that at this, what they were asking us to do was basically take a negative position on marriage equality. I think another important note for us as an organization is that our board recognized was National Council of La Raza, again, is the largest Latino civil rights organization in the U.S. And so they're a very strategic partner to advance day labor and worker rights here locally for us, but as well as across the country. And so to disaffiliate from a strong ally, strong partner, is to weaken our day labor worker rights movement here in the Portland metro area.
I've been speaking with Ronfis Vietoro with the VOS Worker Rights Education Project. The Worker Center is located at 240 Martin Luther King Boulevard in Northeast Portland, just south of the I-84 interchange on Martin Luther King. And their phone number is 503-234-2043.
By plane to Honduras on Monday. According to the U.S. government, the charter flight was the first in a new wave of deportations. There has been a recent explosion in the number of unaccompanied children crossing the border from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. Since October of the last year, 57,000 children have entered the United States. The children are fleeing extortion and violence from organized gangs and drug cartels in their home countries. Honduras' capital of San Pedro Sula has the highest homicide rate in the world.
The death toll in the Israeli assault on Gaza has reached 220, with at least 40 of them children. For the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine, we go to the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, July 16, 2014. On Wednesday evening, four Palestinians from the same family were killed when Israeli fighter jets bombarded an area in Khan Yunis city, south of the Gaza Strip. Two children, Yasmin Al-Astal, 4, Muhammad Al-Astal, 6, in addition to Kawthar Al-Astal, 70, and Hussein Al-Astal, 23, were killed when an Israeli warplane fired missiles into a group of people who gathered in the street, Palestinian sources reported. This attack comes only a few hours after an Israeli naval ship fired multiple artillery shells at children on a beach in Gaza City Wednesday afternoon, killing four children from Becker family between the ages of 9 and 11, and wounding a number of other children. Reporters from AFP and The Guardian witnessed the attack, which took place near a hotel where few foreign journalists in Gaza are staying. According to Palestinian medical sources, the death toll in Gaza have now reached 226, with more than 1,600 people injured. Witnesses in Gaza are saying that Israeli attacks are focused on civilian targets. The latest Israeli military offensive targeting Gaza started last Tuesday. The Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem has issued an information sheet stating that the interpretation presented by the Israeli army, which states that it is enough for a person to be involved in any military activity to render his home and his neighbor's homes legitimate military targets without having to prove any connection between this activity and the house in which he and his family live, is unfounded and illegal. Moreover, emphases such as surgical airstrikes or operational infrastructure used by the Israeli army cannot hide the fact that illegal attacks of homes which constitute punitive home demolition from the air come at a dreadful cost in human life, B'Tselem added. On the political level, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu pledged to expand and intensify the military assault on Gaza in the shadow of failed attempts at an Egyptian-brokered truce. Hamas sources announced that the group has no official stance on the initiative because it has not been decided yet. Furthermore, both Hamas and Islamic Jihad are now reportedly willing to sign a 10-year truce should their conditions be met. Conditions include the halt of all Israeli attacks on Gaza and the withdrawal of all tanks from the borders. Also, the ending of the Israeli siege on the coastal enclave, which has been enforced since 2007. The Palestinian groups also demanded that Israel must free all Palestinian prisoners detained after the abduction and killing of three Israeli settlers in southern West Bank, and that Israel increases the Gaza fishing zone to 10 nautical miles and allows Gaza fishermen to use large fishing ships. Elsewhere, dozens of Israeli military vehicles invaded on Wednesday at dawn several Palestinian communities in the southern West Bank district of Hebron and kidnapped 11 Palestinians, including one legislator. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, July 16th, 2014 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bandura.
U.S. Senate subcommittee today approved a measure that would double the amount given by the U.S. government to Israel for its so-called Iron Dome defense system. The U.S. provides Israel with an estimated $3 billion in direct aid and additional $3 billion in loan guarantees each year. This makes Israel the largest recipient of U.S. aid. The bill will now move to the Senate Appropriations Committee for a hearing tomorrow morning. Oregon Senator Jeff Merkley is on that committee. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Allison Weir, the founder of the group If Americans Knew.
Allison, can you tell us about the decision by the Senate subcommittee to approve doubling U.S. funds to Israel that has just taken place?
Sure. It's astounding. You know, right now, while we see Israeli forces really committing another massacre in Gaza, the subcommittee, the defense subcommittee, has voted to double the amount of money that was going to go to Israel's, quote, missile defense. So now our Congress is poised potentially to send another $621 million to Israel on top of the over $3 billion they get a year, which already works out to about $8.5 million per day. They're about to send them even more.
The Israeli government claims that the Iron Dome is saving Israeli lives and that without it, Israeli casualties would be much higher than they are. There's been one Israeli casualty since the Israeli attack on Gaza began last week in earnest. What do you think of the Israeli officials' claim?
That's actually inaccurate. By the way, rocket fire from Gaza, that was the first person killed by rocket fire from Gaza in the entire year of 2014. The Iron Dome system, which is being funded so generously by American taxpayers, really only targets about, I think it's 28% of the rockets that are fired from Israel, and it's only successful on a percentage of those. So even before Iron Dome was deployed, which was a few years ago, it was something like in all of the years that the rockets have been fired, which began in spring of 2000, before Iron Dome, they had only killed about 17 people in, over 10 years. Now with Iron Dome, it's up to, I think, around 28 people that have been killed by rocket fire.
And how many Palestinians have been killed in that time period?
During that same time period, Israeli forces have killed over 4,000 Gazans during that time period. So if anybody needs a shield from the killing, it would be the Palestinian population.
So this potential increase in funding to the Israeli military has passed the Senate subcommittee, the Appropriations Defense Subcommittee. What's the next step for that bill, and what can people do if they have a concern?
Tomorrow morning at 10 a.m., the full committee of the Senate Appropriations Committee will be considering that bill. At that point, they will either pass that and will go on to the full Senate, or they'll continue what we hope will be a debate about this bill. Right now, many people are calling Congress, are calling the senators on that Appropriations Committee, urging them to vote against sending additional money to Israel. I would suggest that that's a very appropriate action. The committee members are, the list is online. People can call the committee and voice your opinion about what you feel about sending more money to Israel right now.
Senator Jeff Merkley is one of those on that subcommittee. Am I correct on that?
That's correct. He's on the subcommittee. He's at times been very responsive to the Israel lobby that are, of course, come up with important donations for his and other campaigns and are very significant in the mainstream media. So if anybody wants to counter a special interest working on behalf of Israel, this is the time for just average citizens to contact Jeff Merkley and other senators to tell them what you think would be the appropriate thing for them to do, and not just leave it to a powerful lobby to drive our policies on this.
Well, thank you so much for that. I've been speaking with Allison Weir with the Council for the National Interest Foundation and If Americans Knew. You can find more information at ifamericansknew.org. That's ifamericansknew.org. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
The U.S. House of Representatives has extended the Internet Tax Freedom Act. The measure prevents the government from taxing internet access or imposing fees on bandwidth and email. The act, which was set to expire in November, has been extended three times. Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon helped write the measure to prevent various jurisdictions from levying taxes during the internet's early days. He claims that taxes could have stifled economic growth and innovation. Wyden and other lawmakers have asked Congress to make the bans on internet taxes permanent.
In today's weekly city council meeting in Portland, city officials approve a grant of nearly $1 million for the design and construction of the Marine Drive path. The path will be for bicyclists and pedestrians. It will be part of the 40-mile loop, which was approved in 1985, but has not yet been completed. Here are some of the testimony from that item.
Being not those boldest of riders, we said, that's a little sketchy. We're going to turn around and go back west. So I think we're the prototype of the weekend or recreational riders who love this trail, who now will be emboldened to go a little farther and connect to other places at perhaps a slower speed than some of those folks saying, on your left, as they go past us.
There needs to be a moratorium on development, in my opinion, on Marine Drive. Now, why I say that is that we all know that we need to recertify the levee there. Now, in my opinion, as you know, we have two travel lanes currently. I, in my opinion, think we should go to four. I think we need to start planning on bike paths and other forms of transportation on Marine Drive. And why I say that, in my opinion, from the 1996 flood, we were very close on going over the levee. And I think when the engineers come out there and they take a look at it, they're going to want to add more height. And I'm thinking they're going to want to do something with Marine Drive on the levee. And for us to build these projects without having an understanding on what they want to do on this levee, we might build something and then have to remove it. So I'm asking that a moratorium is put into place until we understand the true effects on having to bring this levee up to today's standards. And I think we need to look at that because we're talking a lot of money here. And if we have these projects go forward, we might have to come back and remove them. And I'm just asking that we take that in consideration on any project on Marine Drive, anything that affects the levee, that this is going to be a much more serious situation than I think people are looking at this time. I'm looking at more height on Marine Drive, more width, and I'm looking at properties from the levee to the river actually being possibly bought in from the private owners, because I think to effectively do this levee, they're going to have to really design this and understand that a lot of these properties should have never been sold to private owners that are from the levee to the river itself. And I think they're going to look at this real close, and there's going to be some serious changes, especially along the airport on Marine Drive in some of those properties that I think we're going to see. And any construction and development at this time, I think, is jeopardizing any funding that go to these projects.
In addition to approving the funding for the Marine Drive Trail, the Portland City Council heard a report from students at Kathleen Gable School about the planning and leadership program for envisioning the future of the city. Commissioner Leonard responded to the students' plan for the future of Powell Boulevard, in which the students envision light rail and bike path along Powell.
Oh, your work is really timely, as you know. I mean, you made a really good choice, in my opinion, of where to focus, because we do have this study underway, but we also have a much larger discussion that is now likely to actually get somewhere about whether Powell should continue to be an ODOT highway or should transition to being a city street. And Commissioner Novick and I are both very interested in that subject because he's the transportation commissioner and I'm dealing with the finances of all this. But we both believe that if the funding can be figured out finally, that it makes sense for some of these roadways that are state highways, 82nd is another one, to transition from being, they call them orphan highways sometimes, into being city streets. Because as you've pointed out, they function as a city arterial street. People don't know or care that it has a state highway number on it. They care about safety and livability. So that discussion is getting ripe for change, we think and we hope. And then secondly, the region, and I think you picked up on this in your work, the region has been thinking about the question of bus rapid transit. We've done a lot with rail, both light rail and streetcar. There are more places where those ought to go. We have a good conventional bus network with conventional stops, but as the Eugene Springfield project demonstrated, there are places where that particular form of transit makes sense, right tool in the right place. And I think you've made a wise choice of saying that could work here on Powell.
The City Council approved two candidates for the Planning and Sustainability Commission. Margaret Talmadge was one of the two candidates approved by the City Council. She responded to questions from Commissioner about her priorities.
And you mentioned equity as something you're interested in housing. Clearly a passion of yours. Is there a particular area where you think the city falls short that you'd like to put some additional attention through your service?
I think a huge portion is just reconciling and finding a balance between sustainability and affordability. Most cities are facing that. But as we look at communities out in Lentz or communities out in Coley, they face, you know, a transportation desert, food deserts. So it's creating equitable opportunity for investment. I mean, equitable investment strategies, as well as finding innovative policies to keep those homes, those residences, and those commercial buildings affordable for current residents. So I think that's also something that speaks to wider issue of affordability rather than just the native community.
That was Margaret Talmadge, the first ever youth commissioner approved to serve in Portland's Planning and Sustainability Commission.
A U.S. Census Bureau survey said that Oregon saw one of the highest increases in the nation of people living in areas of concentrated poverty between 2000 and 2010. Oregon is one of four states where U.S. shares people living in poverty in certain census tracts increased by 15%. The data indicates that in 2000, 10% of Oregonians lived in areas where impoverished residents made up more than 20% of the total population. By 2010, that rate by which Oregonians lived with others in poverty had increased drastically. In that year, the rate of Oregonians living in high poverty areas was 26%. A census tract is an area generally comprising 4,000 people. The federal government defines a high poverty tract as one where more than 20% of the people there live in poverty. Poverty is a measure of income as compared to expenditures necessary for survival. A report in March said 23% of Oregon children currently live in poverty. Overall, 17% of Oregonians are impoverished.
You are listening to KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for news from the BOO, an interview with KBOO station co-managers Mike Crenshaw and Monica Beamer, followed by Occupy Portland Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny and clear with a high of 83. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 28 counts per minute in North Portland, 32 counts per minute in Vancouver, Washington. Eugene, Oregon has a count of 35. Hanford, Washington has a count of 33. In North Vancouver, British Columbia has a current radiation count of 33 counts per minute. Counts per minute is a measurement of ionizing radiation events registered by an instrument known as a Geiger counter. Radcast alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org. Today in history. In 1945, the United States becomes the first country to successfully detonate a nuclear bomb when a plutonium-based device is detonated as part of the Manhattan Project near Alamogordo, New Mexico. And in 1979, our ex-president Ahmed Hassan al-Bakr resigns, ceding the presidency to Saddam Hussein. We live in a time where love is strange. It takes us all
to make a change. It is 5:34, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The Moral Monday movement is on the move again.
This feisty coalition, based in North Carolina, is an inspiring model of workaday people coming together to reclaim their rights from far right-wing politicians and plutocrats running amok. Led by the NAACP, tens of thousands of North Carolinians have joined the Moral Monday civil disobedience protests at the state capitol for more than a year. They've outed the extremist governor and legislators who have cut taxes for corporations and the rich while raising taxes on low-income people, cut funds for public education and jobless benefits, and gutted environmental protections and women's health funding. Now, the coalition is going after those political kleptocrats in their districts. The movement has recruited, trained, and sent forth across the state 34 young community organizers with the intention of registering 50,000 new voters this summer. The central rallying cry for this mobilization is for the people to rise up against the atrocious voter suppression legislation passed last year. That law is flagrantly anti-democratic, shutting elderly people, minorities, students, low-wage workers, and other non-Republican voters out of their polling places. This is Jim Hightower saying, the effort to restore ballot rights for all in North Carolina is being called Moral Freedom Summer, which connects it directly to the historic Freedom Summer of 1964. In that heroic campaign, activists struggling to secure the vote for African Americans suffered horrific beatings, firebombings, and a shocking triple murder. 50 years later, after the Tar Heel State's top officials shamed themselves by eradicating fundamental rights gained by the blood of those activists, the people are on the move again. To keep up and offer help, go to moralfreedomsummer-naacpnc.nationbuilder.com.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
A federal judge has ruled that the state of California's death penalty is unconstitutional, saying that it violated the prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment. The ruling was issued in the case of Ernest Dwayne Jones, who was sentenced to death in 1995. Judge Cormac J. Carney cited the long delays in actually executing a convict as a factor. Since 1978, California has sentenced 900 people to die and executed only 13. In his ruling, Carney, an appointee of former President George W. Bush, said that the select few who will be executed in California will have languished for so long on death row that their execution will serve no deterrent purpose and will be arbitrary. The decision can be appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals.
In its quarterly earnings report released today, Bank of America stated that its legal fight against the government to avoid paying for the damage it caused in the 2008 crisis has already cost the company over $4 billion. Banks across the United States are still dealing with the consequences of the 2008 housing market collapse. Citigroup said it agreed to a $7 billion settlement with the Department of Justice on Monday. However, Bank of America has not yet settled the federal investigation into its handling of risky subprime mortgages. Lawyers from Bank of America met with Department of Justice officials on Tuesday, but were unable to come to an agreement. While Bank of America made an offer of $13 billion in cash and consumer relief at the meeting, the Justice Department asked for more. Today, the Associated Press reported that lawsuits have cost Bank of America $4 billion and reduced second quarter earnings by 22 cents per share. Nearly all the bank's legal expenses of the second quarter have been related to subprime mortgages that led to the housing crisis.
A state of emergency has been declared in 20 counties in Washington due to an outbreak of wildfires. The largest of these fires was in Mills Canyon. Yesterday, the fire forced the evacuation of 37 homes. As of today, it's 40% contained. In Oregon, California, and Idaho, wildfires are also raging. Dry vegetation and timber from a three-year-long drought in this western state has fed the fires. California has been hit especially hard by these conditions. In addition to wildfires, the state recently suffered its greatest amount of agricultural water loss on record. The current drought is third most severe on record.
In a report issued by Oil Change International, fossil fuel subsidies by the United States government has grown 45% since President Obama took office in 2009. Last year, U.S. federal and state governments handed out over $21.5 billion in direct tax subsidies. Despite President Obama's recent statements that the United States has a moral obligation to act on climate change, Much of the increase in fossil fuel subsidies can be traced to the Obama administration's energy policy, known as all of the above, and the increase in shale oil production. Solar and wind power currently receive less than 10% of all energy subsidies and contribute 11% of all energy used in the United States. Since 2011, the average price of solar panels has dropped by 47%. The Obama administration has proposed that up to $6 billion in fossil fuel subsidies be ended, but the measures have been blocked in Congress. In 2011 and 2012, oil, gas, and coal companies spent almost $330 million in lobbying Congress and received more than 100 times that amount in direct tax subsidies. Including the subsidies were provisions for oil companies to write off the expenses of an oil spill and an exemption for tar sands oil producers to not pay into an oil spill liability trust fund, in spite of several high-profile spills in the last year of tar sands oil by railcar and pipeline. The report stated that these amounts do not include environmental public health costs such as air, ground, and water pollution. These decentralized annual cleanup and health care costs add up to almost $300 billion per year.
A Swedish court upheld an arrest warrant for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Assange is wanted in Sweden for questioning and allegations of sexual misconduct, though no charges have been filed. Hearing was held today in the Stockholm District Court whether to lift the almost four-year-old detention in absentia for Julian Assange. A verdict was announced later in the day stating that Julian Assange is to remain in detention in absentia. According to Associated Press, his lawyers will appeal today's verdict. Julian Assange has been effectively detained without charge since December 2010. He has now spent 2 years inside the embassy of Ecuador in London, where he was being granted political asylum in relation to U.S. attempts to prosecute him as a publisher of WikiLeaks. Sweden has refused to give assurance that Julian Assange will not be extradited to the United States if he travels to Sweden. The U.S. Department of Justice confirmed in its April 2014 court filing that a national security criminal investigation and pending prosecution against WikiLeaks will proceed.
Airstrikes killed at least 50 people in the North Waziristan region of Pakistan this morning. The Pakistani military reports that its jets, most of which were supplied by the U.S., killed 35 suspected fighters as it began an aggressive anti-Taliban offensive. Although the initial strike has been led by air, a ground operation is also expected. 2,300 soldiers entered North Waziristan on Sunday. Currently, 20,000 soldiers are stationed in the region, including paramilitary forces. Hours before the Pakistani military's attack, local officials reported that a U.S. drone strike killed between 15 and 20 people. U.S. strikes were resumed in Pakistan in June after a six-month break during Pakistan's peace talks with the Taliban. Pakistan opposes the drone strikes, maintaining that they are a violation of its sovereignty. According to Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Tanzim Aslam, the Pakistani military has not confirmed that a U.S. drone strike took place.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, 89 people were killed yesterday in eastern Afghanistan when a suicide bomber detonated a car full of explosives in a crowded market. It was the deadliest attack on civilians by insurgents since the U.S. invasion in 2001. The attack took place in the town of Urgun, district of Paktika province, which borders Pakistan. In other news, Afghanistan's new election audit is set to begin tomorrow. The result of the election had declared Ashraf Ghani as the winner, but challenger Abdullah Abdullah has referred the results, claiming ballot stuffing tilted results in favor of his opponent. Abdullah lost when the general election was too close to call. Ghani was leading in the runoff before Abdullah briefly suspended his campaign and protest. All ballot cast in the runoff, some 8 million voters, will be reviewed in Kabul by representatives for both candidates, select media members, and domestic and foreign observers. Both candidates have agreed to abide by the results in a deal brokered by the U.S.
A Navy nurse at Guantanamo Bay is refusing to be involved in the forced feedings of inmates on hunger strikes. News of his refusal comes from Corey Kreider, lawyer for a Syrian man named Abu Wail Daib, detained in Guantanamo. Kreider and Daib spoke on the phone on July 10th. The nurse told Daib, "I have come to the decision that I refuse to participate in this criminal act." Kreider refers to his defiance as conscientious objection. Force feeding involves the insertion of a tube down an inmate's throat. He is then pumped with food. The dangerous process can result in stomach damage and even asphyxiation. The United Nations Human Rights Office has condemned the act as torture and a violation of international law. Spokesman of Guantanamo Operations, Colonel Greg Julian, says the nurse has been reassigned.
This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Henry Lisha, Yana Maximova, Don Zer, Ramona Funkhauser, and Eric Tygetup. The producer is Mike Klepfer. Our engineer is Jan Westmoreland. The Cable Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. Or look for us on Twitter at kboonews. If you would like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on this news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kitz Haber's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Yana Maximova.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 o'clock on Voices from the Edge Talk Radio, host Joanne Hardesty speaks with LaToya Harris and her daughter, who was arrested by Portland police officers when she was 9 years old following a playground scuffle with another student. At 9 o'clock on Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell, boycott, divest, and sanction racist militarism, honor Jews by demanding the best of Israel. Hear the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, host Per Fuggering interviews Zahir Wahab on the wretched state of Afghanistan and the incredible resilience of the common people there. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, host Jay Thiemeyer speaks with Portland writer Smith Henderson about his highly praised novel, 4th of July Creek, which explores the complexities of freedom, community, grace, suspicion, and anarchy. Thank you for listening to KBOO Radio, and thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a member, you can become one right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
It's time for KBOO News from the Boo with
Mike
and
Monica Beamer.
It is indeed time for News from the Boo,
that
our
was
weekly
great.
Program with, that we have on Wednesdays around this time, when we speak with Monica Beamer and Mike Crenshaw, KBOO's station co-managers, about what is happening inside of and around KBOO. Our phone lines are open. If you'd like to call with a question or a comment, our number is 503-231-8187. That is 503-231-8187. Now, last week, we were running behind, so we did not get a chance to talk about one of KBOO's biggest remote broadcast events, the Waterfront Blues Festival that took place over the 4th of July weekend. How did it go?
It was great. We had 4 days of great music, amazing volunteers, and great engineering. We also had 7 stations from across the state that we were able to send a signal to, who then broadcast the festival in their communities, which was really great. And this was the 27th year for the festival. It raised $1,114,000 for the Oregon Food Bank. And at one point, we had 398 folks streaming the festival online. And we received emails that next week from all over thanking us, including one from Tokyo, Japan. Wow. And so thanks to everyone who made the festival broadcast and KBOO Table run great. We really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
And Mike, you're doing some outreach work involving KBOO and the Portland African American Leadership Forum. What is the PAALF, and how does it work, relate to KBOO?
So Portland African American Leadership Forum is a group of community leaders working to develop leadership skills in young African American people in the community. And they've done a lot of work focused on gentrification and displacement of historically African American communities and working with youth within those communities. They've got a great event coming up I want to say a little bit about. It's called We Are Black, We Are Portland, and it's a community campaign celebrating all that the African American community is in Portland, from North Portland to the numbers. So, you know, I've been here 22 years, and when I was told there was an African American neighborhood, I was told it was North and Northeast. And in that time, people have been displaced from that community. So when they say from North to the numbers, they're talking about that whole geographic area that spans from one side of town to the other. There's going to be food, there's going to be music and entertainment. And that's, let me see the date on this actually. I think it's the 19th, Saturday, July 19th from 2 to 6 p.m.
This Saturday.
Yeah.
Is KBOO involved in setting it up or organizing it?
Not necessarily. I'm somebody that's been doing some work with them, and what I'm interested in developing along with the leaders in PAALF like Rachel Gilmer and some of the other comrades is opportunities for young people that are in their leadership development program to be able to come down to KBOO and learn some skills through internships and training on the technical aspects of, you know, broadcast news, broadcast radio, developing second stream, streaming radio online. So that's what we're looking at doing in the future. And I was just over at Jeff High School today with some of the youth that are in a program that's run in association with SEI. And we were in the classroom just talking about different aspects of justice and race and power and class and society. So,
did you used to teach at Jefferson?
No, you know, I've done a lot of stuff as an independent contractor and educator doing popular education. So basically looking at social justice issues through education in and out of the doors of Jeff for you know, close to 20 years. And so it's just good to be able to stay in the fray and, you know, be in front of young folks interacting.
Thanks for doing that. It's important.
So what other events do we have coming up that KBOO is involved with or co-sponsoring?
Let's see. There's a few things this weekend. We have the Oregon Summer Soiree. It's taking place Thursday and Friday at the Holocene in Portland. Those proceeds will benefit the Portland chapter of Surfrider's Clean Water Campaign. There's going to be an art show, silent auction, of surfing ocean artwork. Wow. There'll be music and movies, of course. And the Portland chapter of the Surfrider Foundation's work is focused on outreach around the Rise Above Plastics campaign, the Snow Rider Project, and the Don't Be a Tosser campaign, water quality testing, and the protection of Oregon North Coast beaches from Seaside to Oswald West. There's also the Jazz Society of Oregon's Cathedral Park Jazz Festival taking place this weekend, Friday through Sunday. And this is 34 years old in 2014. It's the oldest continuous free jazz festival west of the Mississippi River.
Wow, we're proud of that. We'll also be doing a remote broadcast from PDX Pop Now Music Festival this Saturday. And the festival takes place Friday through Sunday, so make sure you get out and check that out on one of those days. PDX Pop Now Festival establishes itself as a spinoff from PDX Pop Listserv and continues to serve as our signature event to this day. The multi-day festival brings scores of Portland artists and residents together in our town and our own urban backyard. Every July, the festival, which showcases up to 50 of Portland's finest bands, draws audiences in the thousands. And since 2004, the fests have collectively stimulated interest, expanded participation, introduced new bands into the fold, and inspired collaborations. You can go to the KBOO website, kboo.fm, and go to the right-hand column under Community Events for more information on any of these events.
You know, we have a few more minutes, and I wanted to return to something that you sort of hinted at just a moment ago, and that was the online users. And I know I always come back to online stuff because it's always so interesting to me. And that you mentioned that we had a user from Tokyo who was streaming the broadcast. Do we have? Obviously, we're aware that we have people who are outside the Portland area who are tracking, who are streaming our shows. Do we have any idea of what kind of numbers we have coming from outside of our general area who are listening into KBOO?
That's a great question. But I don't know.
Ask
the
us
answer.
Next week.
Yeah, right. Let us go to Tom, our chief engineer, and be like, Tom,
sure
give me
knows.
The numbers.
Well,
the reason I ask is it kind of brings up a bigger issue, which is KBOO is community radio, and what is the nature of community? Is community a geographic entity,
right.
Or does community really represent a group of people who may be far flung geographically or physically, but who share common interests and objectives? And if the latter is the case, then as KBOO, are we really trying to extend ourselves to a wider audience than the Portland metro area?
Right, and you can see that in, for example, that email that we received where someone was really grateful to be able to participate in something that was so intimate here in Portland. It was great.
Yeah, and we know that people listen to the radio on the internet outside of Portland, you know. So, for instance, there are people in correctional institutions that get to listen to KBOO on the internet, and that's an awesome opportunity for them to tune in. I've met people who, once they get out, they are like, hey, I appreciate, you know, what you did. I listened to your music every such and such night when it came on. And so there are people all over the world listening, and that's great. I think that community is both those things that you mentioned. You know, it's something that can be localized by geography, but it's also something that can be a state of mind and consciousness and people having common goals and interests wherever.
So if you are one of those people who is listening to us someplace far from Portland right now, do remember this when fundraising time comes around, that just because you may not be physically close to us, you are near to our hearts, and we want you to be part of our community.
One more thing I think is important to mention, we've mentioned the last few weeks, is that we're taking applications for the board of directors right now. So if folks who are interested in throwing in their name and their skills to help out KBOO, it's really important. Then go to the website and find out more about that. And the applications are due at the end of July. So,
and are we also still looking for nothing else? Just board?
That's it.
Okay, excellent. Everything else has been achieved.
Yep. We're moving along. Moving progress.
Progress.
Good. That is excellent news. Anything else you want to toss in before we sign off for the week?
You guys got to start calling us, you know, so we don't have to just sit here and talk amongst ourselves. So, yeah, give us a shout on News from the Boo one of these Wednesday afternoons. We'd love to talk to you.
Yeah, your time's drawing very close now, but if you have a question, do keep it in mind for next week and call early and we'll get you in. Monica, any final thoughts from you?
Just thanks to everyone. Visit the website for all the great stuff that's happening.
All right. Well, thank you, Mike, and thank you, Monica, for coming in once again. We will see you both hopefully next week. And we will talk to you all later.
All right. That's cool.
Thank you. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 34th Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, Friday, July 18th to Sunday, July 20th at Cathedral Park in North Portland. The Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, the oldest continual free jazz festival west of the Mississippi River. This year, Friday night will be a blues night featuring the Roseland Hunters, and the rest of the festival features jazz performers Farrell Newton plus Soul 3, the Portland Youth Jazz Orchestra, the Mel Brown Septet, Devin Phillips, and many more. Again, that's the 34th Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, located in Cathedral Park under the St. John's Bridge in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm.